Coming to you from the HagmanReport.com studio, located in the Keystone State, birthplace of a mighty nation, it's your host, Doug Hagman.
Hello and welcome to the Hagman Report for Wednesday, May 5th, 2021. I'm Peter Barry-Chalka, guest hosting the program again today. Doug Hagman is recovering from laryngitis, and he hopes to be back here in the hosting chair very soon, possibly tomorrow. Now, I'll be riding solo here during the first hour of the program today, except for the excellent behind-the-scenes technical direction of the program by the famous Eric the Tech. And I may also be assisted by the two support cats, Lulu and Biggie, who are around here somewhere but not in camera range at the moment. In the second hour of the program today, I'm scheduled to interview Dr. Linda Isaacs. She's a medical doctor and one of the key clinical practitioners and researchers in the field of non-toxic nutritional cancer therapies. I've interviewed Dr. Isaacs here before twice in 2018, and if you're at all interested in health, including the politics of healthcare, I think you will find that hour and the second hour today very interesting. Now, I originally planned to keep this breaking news for the last segment in this hour, but I'm going to lead with it now because it's very, very interesting. It involves former President Donald Trump. Yesterday, President Trump gave an interview to Candace Owens for her podcast, and in the report on this at Breitbart.com, it's headlined, Donald Trump, quote, people are going to be very, very happy with my 2024 decision. And the article says in the first paragraph that Donald Trump is basically implying that he will be running for president again in 2024. His quote is, I guess she asked him about this, and he said, quote, the answer is I'm absolutely enthused. I look forward to doing an announcement at the right time. As you know, it's very early, but I think people are going to be very, very happy when I make a certain announcement, end quote. The words of Donald Trump. And the second breaking news story that came out yesterday about President Trump, and this was originally an exclusive by Fox News, May 4th, 2021. Their article is titled, Trump Launches New Communications Platform Months After Twitter and Facebook Ban. Exclusive. Former President Trump launched a communications platform on Tuesday, that is yesterday, May 4th, 2021, which will serve as a place to speak freely and safely, and that's a quote, and will eventually give him the ability to communicate directly with his followers after months of being banned from sites like Twitter and Facebook. And the platform, which is called From the Desk of Donald J. Trump, appears on DonaldJTrump.com/desk. Meanwhile, Facebook announced today, that is May 5th, 2021, that their supposedly independent oversight board, after reviewing President Trump's ban from Facebook several months ago, announced their decision to continue the ban. So he is still banned from the major social media platforms and is working to establish his own, although this announcement yesterday about From the Desk of Donald Trump, it's basically, it looks like a blog. It does not, at this point, have the ability to have his followers or fans or supporters interact or post comments, but perhaps that will emerge in time. And as the Fox News story summed it up again, the space that he has created allows President Trump to post and allows followers to share the former president's posts to Twitter and Facebook. However, the new platform does not have a feature to allow users to reply or to engage with Trump's posts. And it remains to be seen if people repost things that he has posted at his site, if they will stay at Twitter and Facebook, both of which have to this point banned him for life, apparently. So that's some breaking news today. Now, yesterday here on the Hagman Report, I had the good fortune of interviewing, or really having a conversation with, the noted author and journalist Diana West during the second hour of the program. And those video and audio podcasts are online now, which you can find most easily at HagmanReport.com, or the video at Rumble, which is rumble.com/HagmanReport, Hagman with two N's. And Diana West, of course, is one of the most impressive people I know. Our conversation yesterday centered on the fraud of last November's election and the increasingly worrisome nature of the COVID-19 plandemic and what is being planned for us right now. And Diana is a very well-informed and a very original thinker. And if you've not heard the show, either when it was being streamed last evening, or you have not had the chance to check out the podcast, I highly recommend that you seek it out, because it's really unique and original, and because of Diana West, it's brilliant. And I thought that her points she made in particular about how paying close attention to the 24/7 news cycle is really bad for body, mind, and spirit. And it wasn't just a factor, like many of us say, that paying attention to places like CNN or the New York Times or the Alphabet channels is bad. Yes, we know they are bad, and they probably raise your blood pressure. But her point of view was a bit different and more nuanced, and I found it really interesting and intriguing, and it resonated with me as well. Now, during the first hour of last night's program here on the Hagman Report, that is Tuesday, May 4th, 2021, I spoke at length about my research and reporting on a frightening new example of the corruption of modern medicine, this time as a result of critical race theory being employed to redirect modern medicine, the practice of medicine, in what can only be termed as a racist direction. Now, it was really sad to have to report this. And tonight, without repeating that, you can go and find the podcast if you wish, or my article about it at American Thinker, which is titled Medical Racism. And as of today, May 5th, that article is still on the front page of American Thinker on the lower left, and it will be there for another 2 days, and then it will scroll off into the archives, but it can always be found by going to my one-page website, peter.media, peter.media, and there's a link there to all of the articles that I've written for American Thinker over the years, about 300 of them, in chronological order, with the most recent first. So the medical racism one is right at the top of my archive list, and that's the easiest way to engage that article after it scrolls off the front page at AmericanThinker.com. So following up on that reporting I did yesterday, which I think is somewhat groundbreaking and something we really need to be aware of, I mean, the next level of corruption of modern medicine. So in this first hour, I want to continue the analysis with some reflections of my own experiences and observations on the based over the years, including during the time of the original civil rights movement in the late 1950s and the 1960s. Now, that period of American history has been much written about, and it's the subject of numerous documentaries and films, but most of them, in my opinion, badly miss the mark because, like everything else today, they have deep political agendas, left-wing political agendas, radical left political agendas. Now, I've been thinking about all of this again lately because right now on most PBS stations around the country, public broadcasting, they are replaying the so-called second season of the influential series Eyes on the Prize, which is about the history of the civil rights movement. And what's showing now on these PBS stations is parts 1 through 8 of what's considered the second season of that documentary series. And it originally aired, in this case, in 1990. So it's 31 years old, but PBS keeps replaying it periodically. And the second season, so-called, has never come out, to my knowledge, on VHS tape or DVD. So if you want to see it, you have to track it down now. Now, in my opinion, while it's very interesting for its historic archival footage and interviews with many of the principals of the civil rights movement who are long gone, most of them by now, of course, not surprisingly, it's laden with a heavy political agenda. And in fact, this series, Eyes on the Prize, and Juan Williams, a person on Fox News who it's very appropriate to dislike, in my opinion, he played a role in Eyes on the Prize, the first season, early in his career. He wrote the book that accompanied Eyes on the Prize, the original season one, episodes 1 through 6, which PBS showed last month. So that's where he started his career. And that series helped to establish radicals like Malcolm X and the Black Panthers and even the rioters in the 60s as having legitimate grievances. So it kind of laid the intellectual and philosophical and historical groundwork for what we see going on now with Black Lives Matter, Antifa, etc. Now, speaking of PBS, I can't let this go without a comment. That channel, which is supported by $400 million a year of our tax dollars, has in recent years morphed into an incredible propaganda arm for the woke left. Now, in 2009, every television broadcast station in the United States was mandated by the government to transition to digital broadcasting. As a result of this technological leap, each PBS station now has between 4 and 5 channels, a main high-definition channel, and 3 or 4 digital sub-channels. So they've got 4 or 5 channels running 24/7 in cities in the United States. And some cities have several PBS channels, so do the math. It's an incredible amount of programming. But in my view, at least 90% of the programming that's, 90% of all of their programming is controlled by PBS National, located in the D.C. swamp. One of these 4 or 5 channels is simply called World, PBS World. It might as well be called Globalism. Each day, and not only during Black History Month, these channels run multiple programs depicting the United States and its history as largely defined by oppression against people of color. I mean, it's just mind-boggling even to consult their schedule and the little summaries of programs and see what they show. The one exception in recent months was a documentary by the Black conservative intellectual Thomas Sowell, S-O-W-E-L-L, whose work I highly recommend, and I was shocked to see it on there, but that was the one exception, probably out of hundreds of programs that take the left-wing radical woke point of view. And after the Republicans took control of the Congress in 1995, during the Contract with America timeframe, their agenda supposedly included defunding PBS and National Public Radio. Too bad that never happened. And the PBS documentary series Frontline, which is in its, I think, 39th season now, it used to be pretty good at times, but now it's descended into total propaganda. After the January 6th events this year at the U.S. Capitol, Frontline did a program called American Insurrection. A preview of it online was titled Examining a Broad Fascist Movement in the U.S., end quote. In other words, Trump supporters. On January 26th this year, that's a week after President Trump left office, Frontline presented another program titled Trump's American Carnage. The description of that was, quote, an examination of how Donald Trump aggravated political divisions and stoked violence throughout his presidency. as well as how his party leaders failed to heed the warning signs, end quote. Well, this should make you sick, especially since our tax dollars are funding PBS, including this kind of propaganda. Now, today, as I said, I want to continue the reporting and analysis that I started yesterday. Several weeks ago, I did a brief video with Jamie Glassoff as part of his Glassoff Gang video series online, which I highly recommend, on a similar topic of medical racism and the history of the civil rights movement. Very brief exchange with Jamie Glassoff, who, by the way, is the editor of Front Page Magazine. And at one point during our conversation on video, Jamie interrupted me and said something like, "Peter, you're not saying that you don't believe that there was racism and segregation in America's past, do you?" And I answered, "No, of course. I'm not saying that at all. After all, I'm a child of that era, and anyone with a heart and a functioning brain recognized during that time that reform was needed. Racial discrimination and segregation had to go away. And they were going away. We were evolving quickly as a liberal, small d, democratic society." Liberal meaning something very different then as it means now. I mean, JFK was a liberal, and he'd probably be a Republican today if he was still around. So the organic reforms that were going on then, they were further institutionalized, of course, by the Civil Rights Act of 1964 that guaranteed public accommodations, which, by the way, was passed mainly with Republican votes in the U.S. Senate, and also the Voting Rights Act the following year, which gave the federal government the power to ensure non-discrimination to voting. But things did not stop there. And as I said, I came of age during the late 1950s and the 60s when the civil rights movement was exploding. Before the Vietnam War really took off in 1965, the civil rights movement dominated the national news. And in the case of most thinking people's minds, the decade of the 60s in retrospect has the well-deserved reputation of being the start of the slow downfall of our republic. I certainly agree with that. But that really refers to or relates to the last part of the decade of the 60s, after the Cultural Revolution took hold and the seeds of our destruction were planted by the Marxist left. It's the first half of the decade that I want to start with here in this commentary. In my opinion, the early years of the 1960s in America were more like the 1950s. The greatest generation that won World War II was still very much in charge of the country. But things were changing by influences like the election of America's youngest president, John F. Kennedy, in 1960, and by the coming of age of the baby boomers. The burgeoning popular culture began to reflect and then to help to drive these changes. It was evolving to include something very new, the youth culture. Things like rock and roll music, the pervasive new media of television, movies, all reflecting and helping to advance the country's underlying unity and the common sense acceptance of integration and an end to segregation and bias against people because of the color of their skin. Now, I mentioned yesterday on the Hagman Report that I began my journalistic career when I entered high school in 1964. And among the people who I had a close reportorial encounter with that fall, specifically on November 30th, 1964, was Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., who spoke in a nearby city. And I took my tape recorder there, put my microphone on his podium a foot or two away from where he spoke. And because I had a short microphone cable, I was allowed to put my recorder just behind him, sitting on the stage to the right rear of Martin Luther King as he spoke, probably 8 or 10 feet away from me. So I heard him say in a version of his I Have a Dream speech that night, again, that he hoped, he looked forward to the day when a man would be judged by the content of his character and not by the color of his skin. I think today there's a good chance you'd be canceled if you said that. In many ways, that period of the mid-1960s, I think, might well have been the best of times in our country's history. It was the high point of what has been called the American century. And I think you'd have to go back to the founding of the country in 1776 and the decade or so afterward to find a period, as significant and influential for the country's future. Now, nothing is perfect, and the times then were certainly not perfect, but all around, I think they were pretty good. When I was growing up, we were taught a true version of American history in public schools where saying prayers was still okay. By the time I was in the sixth grade in public schools, I think I knew more about the American Revolution, the Civil War, and American history than most college students do today. And the popular culture then was steeped in American history and a unifying respect for it and for our country. A TV program my contemporaries and I watched every week was the Walt Disney programming on network primetime TV. It presented accurate, inspiring historic dramas and documentaries about the founders, the Revolutionary War, the settling of the West, and the high points of American history and the country's bedrock traditions. This was all ingrained in us, more or less taken for granted, and its impact continues in some of us to this day, a half century later. Now, when I'm asked what were black-white relations like in the 1960s as I remember them, well, where I grew up, I don't recall racism at all. Because in the early 1960s, we were organically and naturally outgrowing and overcoming these kinds of prejudices that go back centuries, you know, discrimination, segregation. There were leaders around like Martin Luther King and John and Robert Kennedy to inspire us. The Republican Party was more pro-civil rights than the Democrats. And what was going on was probably the greatest mass sea change in public attitudes about race and equality in the history of the country, if not in world history. And the assassination of JFK in November 1963 was an obvious setback, and his successor, Lyndon Baines Johnson, was a nightmare, both a throwback and a sop to the military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower had warned us about in his final address to the nation in January 1961. But somehow we thrived in spite of what was coming with LBJ. The popular culture, television, music, movies, sports, all reflected the optimism and the energy of those times. You just have to listen to the music from that period, the popular music that was on the radio. And it's too bad that we can't play some of it, even clips, because pretty much on any platform, internet platform now, that gets you shut down immediately because of reported copyright violations. But you can find it online, actually, at YouTube, most any song you want there. If you Google it or search the title, I should say, you can find high-quality audio of pretty much any song you ever thought of. And how that is not shut down, I'm not quite sure, but those songs are there. So we had the British invasion that began in February 1964, ushered in by the Beatles, which in many ways owed its inspiration to 1950s American rock and roll, much of it pioneered by black artists, performers, and producers. There was also music like Motown that included acts like the Supremes, Marvin Gaye, Stevie Wonder, The Temptations, The Four Tops. Brilliant music steeped in the traditions of lyrical American popular music. And from my point of view, where I sat, I would put the high point of all of this unity and promise, the height of the American century, at the two-year time frame between 1964 and 1966. Now, that's just my opinion and based on my own very personal view. But at that time, we kids had largely recovered from the shock of JFK's killing. There was, as I said, tremendous optimism. The Beatles' song, "It's Getting Better All the Time," kind of captured the spirit. We really felt that. There were network television programs in prime time, like Shindig and Hullabaloo, dedicated to popular rock music that highlighted white and black performers, their music unifying kids around rock and roll. Now, I remember as a musical person myself, playing guitar and singing in garage bands at the time, I remember those two network TV shows that were broadcast in prime time in 1964, 65, and 66. You had black and white performers, kids grooving to the music, the race notwithstanding, black couples and white couples sharing the dance floor. The future of all of this seemed unlimited. We were getting to mix and know each other, coming together and learning to accept each other without prejudice and without government regulations or intervention. Now, I know this to be true because I've lived it and I experienced it. And since then, I've been reporting on it while I also study the history of that time. And also, as I look in increasing horror at the fake, toxic, revisionist Marxist history that's being shoved down our throats now about that period, but it will never change my memory and the study of that time that I've undertaken. But then, of course, as the 60s went on, around 1966 and 67, the Cultural Revolution happened. It started on the elite campuses and quickly spread downstream to include the high schools and public schools. And by 1970, everything had started to change. Now, I'm also asked, of course, the question, was this change part of a plan to divide and destroy the country? Well, I report, you decide. Here's what happened. In 1962, radical college students representing what they called the New Left met in a Michigan town north of Detroit and issued what they called the Port Huron Statement, the name based on that town. This helped to inspire the Marxist Students for a Democratic Society, SDS, and its later offshoot, the Weather Underground, the violent domestic terrorist group. Many of the most radical members went underground, but they emerged with their leaders like Bill Ayers, who was Obama's friend and mentor, going legit in the 1970s and 80s and becoming influential academics. They planned to take over the country and its institutions in a long march to communism, starting with academia. And they have now largely succeeded, probably beyond the wildest dreams of their original planners. And Bill Ayers, of course, although retired, is still around and still active. Now, in the 1970s, the early 70s, the early Weather Underground dreamed about inspiring a race war and toxic division in the United States that would lead to revolution. They even published their plan so we could all read about it. But they failed because America was too united back then, and it was also defined by a silent conservative majority. So they and their cohorts, that is the radicals, essentially took over academia and began that long march. And everything else eventually was influenced from there. The professions, politics, journalism, media, entertainment, the corporate sector, and now big tech. Everything planned to turn the country and its traditions upside down. Now, recently I discovered a book that was published last year by Christopher Caldwell, C-A-L-D-W-E-L-L, Caldwell, titled The Age of Entitlement, America Since the 60s. Now, his summary of this book is that the civil rights legislation of the 1960s, the public accommodations, 1964, and voting rights, 65, in effect, nullified our Constitution by replacing it with a new Constitution that originated in and reflects the values of the civil rights era in the 1960s. Not to say that many of those values were not warranted, but when they were enshrined into law, which has now been twisted into, well, you know the drill, set-asides, affirmative action, and now actual racism as it's applied to things like the medical system, it got its start in the civil rights legislation of the 60s, according to this author. Now, last month at American Thinker, there was an article by Michael Filozof, F as in Frank, F-I-L-O-Z-O-F, published on April 19th, which summarizes Caldwell's book. And he quotes Caldwell saying, "The changes of the 60s with civil rights at their core were not just a major new element in the Constitution, they were a rival Constitution with which the original one was frequently incompatible." And Filozof also writes, and I believe this is a quote from the Caldwell book, quote, "The Trump presidency exposed the fact that the elites and the deep state are now completely untethered by the original Constitution of limited and enumerated powers and by the Bill of Rights," end quote. And doesn't that pretty much precisely summarize the situation we see today in our largely lawless country? So here we are now, May 2021. It's spring in America, but it often feels like we're on the verge of another dark, dark period, maybe a dark winter. The radical Marxist Democrat controllers of the Congress and the presidency are trying to destroy the independence of the Supreme Court by adding four permanent left-wing justices. They want to shove reparations for slavery down our throats. They propose to institutionalize open borders and the introduction of over 3 million, or probably twice, maybe even three times that many more new illegal immigrants into the country every year. With this H.R. 1 legislation, they want to nationalize voting laws so these illegals can vote and other people can cheat, because the feds will control voting and take over state oversight of elections. They want to destroy the traditional protection of the Senate filibuster, and they want to fire up more racial division and enmity at every opportunity. Every day brings a new, sickening, depressing flood of news reports. And I think you have to look for parallels in past history, like the Marxist takeover of Venezuela by popular election in 1998-99, or dare I say, or even suggest or imply, the rise of Nazi Germany in 1932, also facilitated by election. And by the way, during my conversation with Diana West yesterday, she volunteered an interesting parallel with what the Nazis were up to in the early 1930s, comparing it to some things that are going on here today. So we take a risk in even saying that, but it really has to be said. As it has been said, those who don't reflect on history will repeat it, or learn from history will be cursed to repeat it. Now, as Patriot Thomas Paine wrote in December 1976, which was the start of the first winter of the Revolutionary War and a very dark period, and I love that quote, of course, he wrote, "These are times that try men's souls," end quote. So here we are again. Another thing people ask me online mainly is, well, what happens now? What do you see happening, Peter? Where do we go from here? Well, I'm a journalist, and I don't predict the future. But my short answer is God only knows. Now, we know, those of us who have faith, how the story ultimately ends. And the question is that the only option ahead of us? Or will America, can America be saved, perhaps by divine intervention before the ultimate final chapter, be saved in order to right itself and to recapture its legacy as a shining city on a hill, which is what for most of our country's history it represented. Now, in my opinion, our faith should give us hope that we can turn things around before it's too late. I mean, otherwise, we might as well just give up and crawl into our graves right now. Before America and Western civilization slide into the abyss, leaving the modern world to be ruled by the communist Chinese who gave us the Wuhan virus, we'd better wake up and think and act. And of course, the Chinese, as we know, as the evidence piles up, are in some ways, in some serious ways, demonstrable ways, in cahoots with our current corrupt Marxist-inspired national leadership. Now, I think that prayer can help us to find our way to action that just might work, as it did in 2016, when prayer and action helped to carry Donald Trump over the finish line. As someone said after that, Donald Trump is not perfect, but he's the perfect man for the job. And so it is again. There are other men and women, probably millions of them, millions of us, who are perfect for their roles of helping to save and restore our republic. And maybe even Donald Trump will be one of them again. He may have another shot. And as I've said here and elsewhere many times, I firmly believe that prayer works. In my earlier work as an investigative journalist in the field of the politics of medicine and medical political analysis and reporting on innovative alternative treatments, as I've said before, the number one alternative treatment for serious conditions like cancer is prayer. That's been documented in the scientific literature. That was ahead of changing your diet, taking supplements, taking some herb, taking some immune therapy. Prayer is the number one most widely reported alternative therapy. Now, of course, the medical establishment, in their view, that doesn't mean that prayer works. But there have been some studies in the literature, most of them not too recently for obvious reasons, but there are studies suggesting that prayer does play a significant potential role in healing the sick. So if that is true, and I think we know it's true, don't we? We don't need a study to prove that it's true. But the scientific literature suggests that it has a role. So if so, why would it not be appropriate to pray for our sick body politic, as it's called? It's very sick. It might be terminally ill, but in the case of a person terminally ill with cancer, for example, what are called spontaneous remissions do occasionally occur, some of them very likely at the behest of prayer. And there was also reporting, I'm not sure studies, but reporting that went on decades ago about the effect of the healing shrine at Lourdes, France. There was something called the Lourdes effect. Documented case histories of people who were very sick, who managed to make it to Lourdes, the shrine there, the spiritual place. They prayed, they went home, and they got better. Not everyone, maybe not a majority, but enough to make it, to some extent, statistically significant. So that's some of my feelings about all of that. And in this remaining hour now, first I would remind you, if you're listening or watching tonight, that is May 5th, or you're wondering, shall I stay tuned and hear more of what he has to say? I have a little more in this hour, but in the second hour of the program tonight on the Hagman Report, I will be welcoming as a guest Dr. Linda Isaacs, and you will get to hear what she has to say in depth and commercial free for most of that hour. So I think you might want to stay tuned, plugged in for that. There's a few more news events that I focused on in the last 24 hours that I wanted to bring to your attention in the waning minutes of this hour. First, there was a statement by White House Chief of Staff Ron Klain, K-L-A-I-N. Many political observers suggest that he's playing a very significant role in running the Biden administration because we suspect, if not know, that Joe Biden himself is not only the accidental president, but he's not really on top of his game too much, is he now? So anyway, this Ron Klain said yesterday on a broadcast, of all places, of CNN's AC360, Ron Klain said that the administration has been advised by White House Chief Medical Advisor Dr. Anthony Fauci that herd immunity is, quote, probably a phrase that doesn't really apply here to this particular virus and this circumstance, end quote. Now, similarly, several days ago, there was a page one story at the New York Times, the newspaper of record, also suggesting that herd immunity for the virus, which was expected to come about either naturally or through the injection of the vaccines, quote unquote, into so many million Americans, would eventually result in herd immunity and we could get back to normal. But now these political poobahs are starting to plant the seed of doubt that herd immunity will ever kick in this case. So they're planting the seeds for something here, and I don't think it's very good. So Anderson Cooper, the host of that CNN program, asked Klain, quote, is herd immunity still the goal of the administration? Because, as you know, Dr. Fauci, among others, have sort of backed away from using that term as a benchmark, end quote. And Klain's exact quote is, I think I'll let Dr. Fauci comment, obviously, on the science of that. What he's advised us is that it's probably a phrase that doesn't really apply here to this particular virus and this circumstance, end quote. Now, here's another interesting story. And the source of this, well, it was reported by Breitbart.com, one of my favorite sources online, but it refers to a public opinion poll nationally by Rasmussen, which is considered a right-of-center pollster that usually gives credence and balance to conservatives when it does its polling. And the results of this poll were a plurality of Americans say people should, quote, continue wearing masks in public, end quote, even after being fully vaccinated. So here's the lead paragraph. A plurality of American adults believe that vaccinated individuals should continue wearing masks in public even after being vaccinated, a Rasmussen Report survey released Tuesday showed. Over 105 million people in the U.S. have now been fully vaccinated, representing 31.8% of the U.S. population, according to the Centers for Disease Control, May 3rd data. With a growing number of Americans getting vaccinated, the CDC released updated guidance for those individuals, which continues to instruct them to wear masks in certain social settings despite their status as fully vaccinated. So when Rasmussen, between April 29th and May 2nd, asked respondents about the CDC or just the claim, should people who have been vaccinated continue wearing masks in public, the results were, let's see, 49% said yes, 43% said no. Predictably, opinions are sharply divided on party lines, as a majority of Republicans, 67%, say they should not continue wearing masks in public, while 75% of Democrats said such individuals should continue wearing masks. That sounds like it might be in the right ballpark to me. I know we're always suspicious of polls, but I don't think all of them should be instantly ruled out. Well, here's an item of concern that popped up yesterday. Canada will absolutely require vaccine passport for international travel. From Breitbart again, Canada will, quote, absolutely, end quote, require Chinese coronavirus vaccine passports for international travel, the country's health minister said in an interview with Canadian Public Radio. Now, apparently this means they will require passports if someone wants to travel internationally outside of Canada. In other words, leave Canada, you're going to have to show some kind of vaccine immunology or immunosupportive passport. Here's a quote. Canadians urged to be able to have the right kind of certification for international travel because, as we know, Canadians will want to travel internationally, and they will want to make sure that they have the right credentials to do that from a vaccination perspective, end quote. That was a quote from the Canadian Health Minister, Patty Haidu, H-A-I-D-U, as she told The House, a radio program of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, or CBC, on May 1st. So, once again, yesterday in my conversation with Diana West, we touched on the issue of vaccine passports, and I reflected back on reporting I had done in 2007 for American Thinker, actually among my first extensive and substantive articles in American Thinker, and those articles are still online. They can be accessed by going to my one-page web portal at peter.media, clicking on the archive of my American Thinker articles, and if you scroll all the way down the list to the first ones, you will find these articles on what were termed electronic medical records. This is something that was mandated by the federal government recently. In fact, I think in 2015, it actually kicked in. And now, as we sit here today, 2021 May, pretty much all medical offices in the United States, physicians, chiropractors, osteopaths, licensed naturopaths, etc., acupuncturists, have to be tied in electronically to a federal database where the medical records of all of their patients are kept. Well, first they're kept on site in a physician's or provider's office, hospitals too, of course, and then they have to be shared with this massive federal central database. So, as again, the federal government now knows everything about all our personal health. And apparently there's no way out of this, I learned to my dismay a number of years back when I saw an eye doctor, and she assured me that her records would not leave her office. But by the end of that first visit, she let it drop that, oh, of course they go to the big cloud government portal in the sky. So, and so it goes. Now, this article also caught my attention, which dropped yesterday. And yesterday, again, I was talking about medical racism and other examples of these kinds of things where, amazingly, people of the right color, that is black, brown, Asian, illegal immigrants, are now being favored in medical care, in medical treatments, while people who are white, I mean, that's a color too, isn't it? But people who are white are put on a waiting list. This is actually happening, put on a waiting list for tests or treatment, as people of color are fast-tracked It's happening. And I cited examples yesterday. But I also cited examples how we've been building up to this by preferential treatment for those who pass the color test, the right color, actually going back to the late 60s with affirmative action and quotas and set-asides and government regulations and all. But in more recent times, there are examples which we hadn't seen before. For example, this came out yesterday. Biden coronavirus relief prioritizes funds for non-white business owners. Here's the lead. Restaurants and venues owned by white men will be the last in line for federal relief under President Joe Biden's, quote, Restaurants Revitalization Fund, end quote, or RRF, which prioritizes funds for women and minority groups first. As part of Biden's American Rescue Plan Act of 2021, the Small Business Administration, SBA, is opening the application process by which owners of restaurants, bars, and other venues can apply for federal relief to help make up for the loss of revenue as a result of economic lockdowns spurred by the Chinese coronavirus crisis. By the way, this is from, again, Breitbart.com, so they have no fear about referring to the COVID-19 as the Chinese coronavirus crisis. Good for them. Continuing. The plan allows business owners to apply for relief of up to $10 million per business and no more than $5 million per physical location. Business owners do not have to repay the funds so long as the money is spent by March 2023, or almost 2 years from now. The relief, though, is being prioritized, and there are links in the Breitbart article to the primary sources here, so they're not making it up. The relief, though, is being prioritized based on race, gender, and whether or not business owners are considered socially and economically disadvantaged individuals, end quote. White men, for example, who are not veterans of the United States Armed Forces are not eligible for priority period processing and funding. Now, this is strikingly similar to some of what I reported yesterday and also what I covered in my article, An American Thinker, 9 days ago now, still on the front page of AmericanThinker.com on the lower left, titled Medical Racism. I talked about the intrusion of critical race theory into the practice of medicine actually throughout the United States now. This is becoming the new bedrock as proposed by the number two medical journal in the world, The Lancet, which in an article recently described racism as the most significant health crisis facing us. No, not COVID-19. Not cancer, which takes over 700,000 Americans' lives every year, not AIDS, not heart disease, not diabetes. No, the main health crisis facing us is racism, according to the powers that be. So it's like a full spectrum assault on common sense and equality rather than equity. With all of these things happening on all of these different fronts, and now they're being institutionalized because of the role being played by the Democrat socialists, Marxists, who've taken over the Democrat Party. This is no longer your father's Democrat Party from the past. Even the party of Bill Clinton, it makes the 90s, when Clinton was in power, I never thought I'd say this, look much more preferable to now, because Bill Clinton, and even to an extent Hillary then, to some extent, were more moderate, if not conservative. Bill Clinton announced at a State of the Union, quote, the era of big government is over, end quote. Well, that's been turned on its head by Biden, the Democrats, and whoever's running the show there now. Now, another news event that's come up in recent days, we've had an insight or insights into the thinking of Liz Cheney, the daughter of former Vice President Cheney, who allegedly had a, reportedly, probably had a very significant role in the administration of Rhino George W. Bush. Well, Liz Cheney, a chip off the old block, who got herself elected as the representative in the House of Representatives from the state of Wyoming, where she has a residence, and I believe she's the only member of the lower house, the House of Representatives from Wyoming, because it's a low population state. Anyway, she has revealed herself as even to the left of most rhinos, that is Republicans in name only, like someone like Mitt Romney. And Liz Cheney has been, oh, and by the way, she has a leading leadership position among the Republicans in the Congress. Her position is the GOP conference chairwoman. So she plays a significant institutionalized role in the United States Congress among the Republican Party. But she has been consistently making statements decrying President Trump and his administration. She's been blowing up out of all proportion, in my opinion, and in the opinion of Diana West as well, what happened at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th of this year, which, if not actually a false flag or a partial false flag, was certainly egged on in terms of agitation by members of the left, and again, blown out of all proportion. When you have Democrats saying this is the most significant example of insurrection since the Civil War of 150 years ago, outrageous. Okay, the music is upon us. We're just minutes away from hour number two, my guest, Dr. Linda Isaacs. So please stay tuned for that. I know you're really going to enjoy my conversation with Dr. Isaacs. This is Peter Barry Chalka closing out hour number one on the Hagman Report for today, May 5th, 2021, sitting in for my friend Doug Hagman, who is recovering from laryngitis. Please stay tuned. Back to you.
Reporting on what the mainstream media won't, you're listening to the Hagman and Hagman Report on the Global Star Radio Network.
Welcome to the second hour of the Hagman Report for Wednesday, May 5th, 2021. Doug Hagman is off today because he has laryngitis, and you can hardly host a talk show when you have laryngitis. So he's asked me to fill in for him today, and I'm very happy to do so. As many of you know, I'm an investigative journalist, a medical political analyst, an occasional broadcaster, and a frequent talk show guest. And Doug asked me to sit in for him today because I have a long history with the Hagman Report. I had a regular guest spot here for about 3 years, and I've made over 150 appearances on the Hagman Report, including doing over a dozen interviews with A-list guests. And I've also guest-hosted the program more than a dozen times. In this hour, coming up right now, I'm going to welcome another A-list guest, and she's a return guest, who's one of my favorite people in the world of medicine, particularly innovative natural health care for serious diseases, including cancer. It's Dr. Linda Isaacs, and here's her short bio, which is just a very brief outline of a career of substance. Linda L. Isaacs, MD, is a graduate of Vanderbilt University School of Medicine and is certified by the American Board of Internal Medicine. She offers individualized nutritional protocols for patients with cancer and other illnesses, as well as protocols for health maintenance. She and her colleague, the late Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez, worked together for more than 20 years, publishing articles together about their results. After many years in New York City, Dr. Isaacs relocated her practice to Austin, Texas in 2019, where she joins us from now via video Skype. And I would say that was a good move considering where New York City is at these days. And before we chat with Dr. Isaacs, I recommend that you, the listener and viewer, visit her website, which is drlindai.com. That's D-R, Linda I, all one word, drlindai.com. So, Dr. Linda Isaacs, welcome back, and thank you for joining me today.
Well, thank you so much for having me on the show, and I certainly hope Mr. Hagman feels better soon. But in the meantime, I'm very glad to see you.
Thank you, and likewise. And yeah, I think Doug is improving, and I believe the plan is for him to return to the host chair tomorrow, Thursday, May 6th. So we're all wishing him well and even saying prayers for his recovery. Now, Linda, and I feel comfortable calling you Linda on a first name basis because we're friends. This is the third time that we've had an opportunity to have an uninterrupted, long form conversation here on this platform. And the first two took place in the latter part of 2018 before you moved your practice from New York City to Texas. So I'd like to start our conversation there by asking you what prompted that move after so many years in New York, and how it may have changed your practice, the move from New York to Austin.
Well, I was originally in New York City because of my longtime association with Nicholas Gonzalez. Nick, as you and I both knew him, because obviously we worked together and you and he were friends for many, 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 many years. And Nick was a native New Yorker, and so he and I met actually when he was doing his medical internship at Vanderbilt, which is where I went to medical school. But he wound up going back to New York City kind of like a homing pigeon, and so I went with him because I wanted to work with him. But I'm not a native New Yorker, and when he passed away, of course, you know, after the initial period of just being stunned and grieving and et cetera, I started to think about whether I really wanted to be in New York. It's such an expensive place to work, and I felt like I needed to be someplace where I could have a reasonable-sized office at an affordable price, not to mention the change in lifestyle. Because now, in my current location, I'm paying half the rent for my office that I did in New York City, and I have a 10-minute commute as compared to an hour on mass transit, and I have a much cheaper and better living situation. So all in all, life is very pleasant here in Texas, and I gather that a fair number of New York City residents are thinking the same kind of thoughts these days. It's a great place to visit, but I decided I really didn't want to live there anymore.
Well, I'm glad that you've not only settled into your new home in Texas, but that you appear to be enjoying the experience. And I guess you were a little ahead of the curve there, because now that the COVID-19 lockdowns have moved into their second year, we see many people leaving places like California, New York, and other states where the draconian lockdowns continue, and moving to places like Texas, which are far more open and free. Now, you mentioned, of course, Dr. Gonzalez, and your clinical practice with both associated with him and now influenced by him. We'll have a chance to talk about him later in this hour, but that practice, my understanding, involved close in-person consultation with your patients who traveled from all over to see you and Dr. Gonzalez. And how has COVID-19, I wonder, changed how you are engaging with your patients now? Do you do Zoom or Skype interaction with them, or do most of them still manage to make their way to see you in person?
Well, I don't use those specific platforms, but I am using telemedicine, in effect, quite a lot. I do have a few people that decide that they want to come in physically, but realistically, for most of them, telemedicine is fine. I find that it works just as well for what I do. I certainly would encourage them to have a local physician, but I do that anyway. And much of the time, really, what I'm basing my evaluation and recommendations on is about symptoms they're telling me about or test results, as opposed to actually having to physically lay hands on people. So I think some types of work, like I don't think a chiropractor could do things virtually or an acupuncturist. But for what I do, it's actually working out okay.
Well, that's very interesting. And again, my assumption is that your interaction with your patients, whether it's in person or remotely, is a significant, fairly substantive, lengthy interaction. It's not just a 5 or 10 minute hit and run, but you really get to know them, their situation, and their needs. Is that correct?
That is correct. The initial appointments that I have with people, I spend a total of 4 hours with them typically, either them telling me their story or me telling them what I think they need to do with telling them why they need to do it as well, since why is almost as important as what. If, in other words, if people don't understand why I'm recommending something, they're not too likely to do it. So I do spend a lot of time with people. And the telemedicine platform is more tiring, but it also is making it a whole lot easier for people. And I do hope that some of the restrictions on telemedicine that have been put in place in the past will be relaxed going forward, because I think the medical world in general is realizing there's a lot to be said for it.
Now, what were some of those restrictions? I'm not familiar with that.
Well, it's not so relevant for me, because a lot of what I do, you know, insurance companies aren't going to pay for anyway, but there have always been limitations on what insurance companies would pay for telemedicine as opposed to in-person. All of that has been lifted right at the moment. But there are also some interesting restrictions as far as medical licensure and the location of the doctor and the patient. And it's my hope that some of that will be a more permanent basis going forward. But we'll see.
Yeah, I did wonder about that when I was engaging with another medical doctor who has a practice that entails far-flung consultations all over the country, if not the world, and wondered, does that require a license in each state that you're dealing with someone? But I guess at this point, we should have you summarize briefly what your practice of medicine entails, and how does what you do differ from how standard medicine treats, for example, a person with a form of cancer?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I see patients with conditions other than cancer, but I think cancer is probably what I'm best known for, what Nick and I were best known for, and the majority of the patients that I see do have that condition. And so standard evaluation and treatment of a patient with cancer typically involves First of all, of course, wanting to know what type of cancer it is, which would require usually a biopsy. Secondly, knowing whether the cancer is localized or has spread throughout the body, and then deciding what type of surgery, what type of treatment. And the standard treatments would involve potentially surgery, radiation, chemotherapy, immunotherapy, one of the latest treatments in the orthodox medical world. So that's what's available in that paradigm, so to speak. What I offer is a nutritionally based method, which involves three general components. One would be a large amount of pancreatic enzymes, and there's actually more than a century old reasoning behind using pancreatic enzymes in cancer treatment. Then there's adjustment of the body's physiology using diet and nutritional supplements. And then finally, there's detoxification, which involves getting rid of waste materials through various techniques. Now, the treatment that I offer is fundamentally not generally accepted. So it's not something that I would recommend someone do if they have a clear-cut curative option in regular medicine. So for instance, if someone contacts me with localized cancer, like breast cancer, colon cancer, something like that, I'm going to tell them to go ahead and get the standard treatment. But there are some situations where standard treatment is not going to be curative. And in fact, it may not really do that much. And that's the kind of patient that typically comes to see me, or patients who have already finished the surgery, the whatever treatment could be curative, and then want to come to see me because they feel like they wouldn't have gotten cancer in the first place if their body had been working properly.
Well, that's interesting. And when I did a lot of on-the-ground reporting back in the day when I was covering alternative cancer therapies here and abroad, particularly in Mexico and Canada, many of the clinical locations that were doing those kinds, offering those kinds of alternatives to patients, were seeing patients who mainly had been given up for hopeless by their conventional doctors back home. So they made the trek to northern Mexico or someplace in Canada, Toronto, to seek, or even in the United States, often underground, so they could seek an alternative therapy. And I wonder if you have kind of a ballpark figure of, say, based on what you just answered there, of roughly what percentage of the people who wind up as your patients are pretty much given up by their physicians at home, and this is maybe the last option that they have found.
Well, given up is a funny phrase, a way to put it in this era, because quite frankly, at this point, there's so much in the orthodox armamentarium that the doctors don't tend to give up on people quite as soon as they used to.
Well, maybe, I, not to interrupt, but maybe I should say, put it this way, that the patients, yeah, it's true, doctors, even going back decades when I was doing on-the-ground reporting, doctors would rarely say to a patient, you know, that's it, we have nothing more for you. They'll just keep giving them some therapy, even if they're going downhill all the way to the end. But maybe I should have qualified by saying the patient himself or herself felt that they'd run through everything that their local physician had to offer, and now they want to see some light at the end of the tunnel. So it would include, you know, their evaluation of their situation too.
Yes, well, most of the patients that come to see me are really pretty intelligent people that do their own research. And so they investigate what the situation is, and they realize that orthodox medicine is not going to cure their disease. So in some cases, it's because they've gotten some orthodox treatment and it made them so sick they never wanted to do that again. But in many cases, it's just they did the research and realized it was time to try something completely different. And what I encourage people to do is really look over my website, see what's there, see the rationale behind what I'm doing, and decide if it makes sense to them. But again, you know, if someone's got a proven curative option, that's what they should do. Unfortunately, for many patients with cancer, there is no such proven curative option. And that's the kind of patient that many times will decide to come see someone like me. I will say, though, you know, stepping back to that that idea that even back when you were investigating alternative clinics in the 80s, that the Orthodox community could always come up with something to do. There are a couple of documents I have that are letters that were written by oncologists or physicians, I don't remember exactly who, to major medical journals, basically saying that while, you know, it was in some ways hard to make the argument to give a treatment that doesn't work, that you know is highly unlikely to help a patient, at least it keeps them out of the hands of the quacks, which I thought was remarkably silly because quacks are defined as people who offer useless treatments. So therefore, the oncologists are saying we're better quacks than those other quacks, which I thought was really quite strange.
Well, now that you mention that, it brings to mind in my memory a similar spin. I believe it was the American Cancer Society, which suggested indeed that any treatment or approach offered by medical orthodoxy was preferable to anything else that was considered unorthodox, no matter how promising or how many positive anecdotal reports of success, because it was essential to keep the patient at all costs oriented towards allopathic conventional medicine, come hell or high water. So that wasn't often publicly admitted unless you really delved very deeply into, as you said, you discovered it in some letters, and I came across it in documents issuing from or inside the medical establishment at the time. But it's a long and tortured story looking at the politics of medicine, in particular the politics of cancer. And one other comment I would make here based on my own voluminous research and reporting in the area. Again, the American Cancer Society for many years published a book titled Unproven Methods of Cancer Management. And virtually all of the leading proponents of that time, the 60s through the 90s, when I think that book was still being published, wound up with chapters in that book. And the chapters would then be published in the Cancer Society's journal CA as standalone chapters. And I believe even people on the level of a Linus Pauling, PhD, two-time Nobel Prize winner, wound up on what we, that is, reporters and critics of the cancer establishment, used to call a blacklist. You know, everyone would wind up there. And I believe it was Ralph Moss in his reporting and others found that a majority, a vast majority of the people on this official or semi-official blacklist of alternative cancer therapies, which was worshipped by the cancer establishment during that time, a vast majority of these individuals, clinicians, researchers, had advanced degrees from credible, if not leading, institutions of higher learning. They did not fit the profile of a quack. The definition there is of someone who is basically unlettered, untrained, unqualified, uncredentialed, and is literally offering snake oil. Mm-hmm. So everybody was painted with the same brush, and I guess, I mean, I'll get to that question later on of how things have changed, but it is interesting to delve into the ins and outs of your practice, because I sense that what you're doing, well, I know that what you're doing is very unique and highly principled, and is also based on not only anecdotal evidence over the decades accumulated by you and Dr. Gonzalez and Dr. Kelly before him. But that gets me to my next question, and which is your medical work today has as its source the contributions not only of Dr. Gonzalez, but of Dr. William Donald Kelly, who started in the late 1960s and worked productively through the 1980s on inaugurating this form of non-toxic or less toxic nutritionally detoxification-based therapy. And then, of course, it was picked up by Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez, who took Dr. Kelly's work of biochemical individuality, metabolic typing, and detoxification to new levels, all the while associated with you as his colleague. And I reported on the first wave of innovation in natural medicine, including for cancer from the 1970s onward. And I would put Dr. Gonzalez, and you, again, were his longtime associate, so I would put both of you at or near the very top of my list, clearly in the winner's circle. And Dr. Nick Gonzalez's sudden death in July 2015 at age 67 was a tremendous loss. And by the way, it should be noted, I want to note it right here and now, for anyone watching or listening to this conversation, if you Google, or I should say if you search the name of Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez or his mentor, Dr. William Donald Kelly, which is spelled K-E-L-L-E-Y, you're going to find mostly fake news and lies. So be prepared to look between the lines. And again, a good place to start is my guest's website, Dr. Linda Isaacs at drlindai.com, and that's drlindai.com. Now, that's one reason you're here today, Dr. Isaacs, to give us a clear, truthful picture of your work and your longtime friend and colleague, Dr. Gonzalez. And I know you had a lifetime of experience with him, certainly in your adult life. And I wonder what you can share with our audience about the man who you knew and worked with all of that time. And we can certainly find out about his clinical and research accomplishments. He left a legacy and a published record, which is being added to by Mary Beth Gonzalez's work at the Nicholas Gonzalez Foundation in publishing manuscripts into book form. But what can you share with us, just in a more personal way and a professional way, about what it was like to know and to work with Dr. Gonzalez during those many years that you two were closely associated?
Well, I think anyone who goes to YouTube and watches any of the videos that are available of lectures that he gave can recognize very quickly that he was absolutely brilliant. He was very passionate about what he did and very determined to do the best that he could for the work, but also for the individual patients. I know that many of the patients that he saw that are now seeing me say they think about him every day and miss him still. So he made a very profound impact, I think, on most people that he met. Like I said, he was brilliant. He was determined. He worked very, very hard, which I think is, you know, he could have rested a whole lot more than he did. I think that contributed to him passing away the way he did. He also had a crazy sense of humor, but I'm blanking on exactly what to use as an example. I suppose one example that may or may not be the best one to give, but when we moved into office space in New York City, I mean, we had rented space from another physician and then moved into one that he had built specifically for our practice. And then one of our staff also had a background in decorating, so she went and got a lamp for the patient bathroom. It was a standing, the bathroom was quite large because it had to be able to accommodate wheelchairs. And so she got this standing floor lamp that looked like a bamboo tree. It had little leaves and twigs and stuff on it. And Nick walked in and took a look at it, and he said, oh, well, if a patient brings their dog, they can use the bathroom too, which is one of, that's just sort of, I don't know why that specific example came.
That's pretty good.
But he definitely had an interesting sense of humor. So it wasn't all, you know, gloom, doom, and cancer medicine and grim determination. He could also also be very, very funny.
Yeah, well, as you noted, I knew him for 25 and a half years, and I considered him probably my best male friend in the world. We had the kind of friendship which, even if we hadn't talked or emailed for a length of time, whenever we would reconnect, it was like we picked up immediately from where we left off. Preliminaries were not necessary. It's just, Peter, how you doing? Thanks for calling. You know, just a genuine, warm friendship that at that time and since has not been equaled by any other male friends that I have. And, of course, it also involved in-person encounters, including the very first one, which I never forgot. And I mentioned that in the article about Dr. Gonzalez that I wrote in Alternative Medicine magazine that was published, I believe, in 2003. And, a great, great loss when he passed away, both personally, of course, for anyone who knew him, including his many patients, but professionally, when you realized the, as you said, the brilliance. He was clearly a top-tier intellectual, but he was also, at least with me and with others I saw him with, very down-to-earth. He didn't put on airs at all. He was just a regular guy, Dr. Nick, and he also had interests way beyond medicine. And as you said, he worked tirelessly on his profession, the practice of medicine and research, and in sharing his knowledge and experience. But he had so many other interests too, including politics. And I love to compare notes with him on things that were happening politically, especially as they related to medicine, you know, the onward rush towards more government involvement leading to socialized medicine and, God forbid, single payer. And unlike many of the people who were moving into the forefront of innovative alternative medicine, who were holding fast to their earlier training or propagandizing on the left, Nick was a stalwart conservative and a traditional patriot and, you know, a very spiritual and religious man as well. So he was so well-rounded and to match his brilliance that he's just completely irreplaceable. And now I want to ask you about this. An ongoing theme of the COVID-19 pandemic is the censorship of medical and other information that does not conform to the party line that's emanating from medical bureaucrats, politicians, and big tech. And I talked about that aspect of life today with my guest on this segment yesterday on the Hagman Report, that is May 4th, 2021, who we compared notes on that. And I wanted to go into that area with you. And in an earlier time pre-COVID, what was the response of the mainstream and maybe the non-mainstream to the work of Dr. Gonzalez and yourself? I mean, my memory is it was always considered highly unconventional. And when I was serving on two advisory panels of the National Institutes of Health's then new Office of Alternative Medicine in the early to mid-1990s, of course, the work of Dr. Gonzalez was preeminent in our discussions because he was very much on the front burner then. But yet he had his naysayers and his critics, and it always seemed to be a fight between the truth and the quackbusters who never gave up trying to bring him down. But was there also a sense that his work and your work was being censored during that period, say in the 90s, the early 2000s, when you really began to gain more public notoriety or viability and possibly censorship to boot?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I'll be interested to hear what you have to say after I say what I'm going to say. And that is that, you know, in the 90s, in the pre-internet era, I feel like the mainstream media, so to speak, definitely had a negative view of this kind of work. You know, the typical coverage would be negative, almost always. And so in the current age, so to speak, we have people who are getting their, you know, Google is no longer serving up their information with searches. People are having their YouTube channels pulled, whatever. But in a way, you know, it's almost like we've had a golden age of free information and now it's disappearing. That's the way I wind up thinking, because it's not like it was spectacularly better in the 80s and 90s. You know, I can remember back when Nick and I were actually living with Dr. Kelly and we were stamping on, you know, licking envelopes and stuffing envelopes to mail stuff out to the patients, because you really had no other way to communicate with anybody. So I don't know. It's hard for me to compare. I just feel like the internet has made it easier, to exchange information, but, you know, private companies are doing what private companies are, you know, allowed to do. And it's not as if, you know, the Washington Post back in the 90s did positive articles about us, because they certainly didn't. So I'm not sure how different it really is, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
You know, this is, I really appreciate the opportunity we have to discuss some of these areas in this 1 hour time frame, commercial free, interruption free, because it's rare. And these are complex areas. I realized that again yesterday when I was interviewing in this segment Diana West, the author I referred to earlier. And she and I are largely in the same place in terms of what our research has opened us up to. But we're coming from very different directions. And she was sharing some very original thoughts on things like how it's bad for body, mind, and soul, in effect, to follow obsessively the 24/7 news cycle, not only because, as a conservative that she is, you know, subjecting yourself to something like CNN or the New York Times, which is just going to make you angry and possibly raise your blood pressure, but really all of this news from whatever source is debilitating, if that's what your main focus is. And just on a personal note, I struggle with that feeling, not articulated as well as she did yesterday, in my own life, having to virtually devote every waking moment and then some to try to keep up with all the political news and now the medical political news again. And there's just too much. And it can drive you crazy. And, you know, as opposed to now looking back to earlier decades, and particularly I'll focus on the 1980s, because I agree with you, even though a majority of the coverage of innovative alternative medicine then was probably negative, there was a fair amount of coverage in the mainstream media and opportunities, and some of it wound up being positive. Just from my own experience, now I'm not a clinician, I'm a journalist, but I would get myself booked on programs in the mainstream media, television, radio, some of them national, many in Canada that were national. And in my experience, more often than not, I got, even if the other side was represented by a physician guest who would be debating me, more often than not always, but more often than not, I got what I considered a fair hearing, in which I could give out my information, talk about my work. And I mean, an example, here's just one example, which I reflected on recently, because in 1981, my friend then, the late Robert DeBraga, who founded Project Cure, he and I did a lot of media together in the first years after we met. It was a great team, him, the recovering patient looking for fair evaluation of alternative therapies, and me, the crusading, gallivanting journalist, kind of. So we were a great team. And we got ourselves booked on the number one evening radio talk show in Boston, which was hosted then on WBZ, a 50,000 watt station, clear channel that could be heard in 38 states at night on a regular radio. Mm-hmm. We got ourselves on the David Finnegan Show, and he was a political figure who had run for mayor and almost won of Boston. And I sent him the usual packet of material, some of my articles, talking points. And when we got to the studio at WBZ to do this in-studio program with him, he had read all of my material. And in listening to the tape cassette, which I recorded, and this is like 40 years ago now, I was just blown away by the intelligence of the dialogue. He was completely open to what we were saying, and we were pushing the envelope. We were coming on like gangbusters against the cancer charities and the National Cancer Institute and all the nonsense that was going on then in the bloated war on cancer, and still is, by the way. And it reminded me that, you know, I don't think I would have continued doing that if I was just getting beat up every day, because, you know, it certainly wasn't my interest to do that if I didn't feel like the information was getting out. Now, you flash forward to today, and yes, we have the internet, which is kind of the Wild West out there. You don't know what you're going to get. But in terms of the mainstream, it's very, very rare to hear anyone in the mainstream on a clinical level talking about some kind of innovative alternative treatment for anything, not least cancer. And yet that was pretty widely covered and open. And also in the decade of the 70s, that might have been the high point, with a therapy like Laetrile out there, which galvanized both public and media attention, and much of it negative, certainly. But, you know, the other way of looking at it was patients who I would meet at these offshore clinics, in particular in Mexico or Canada, say offshore is a name there, they would say that they first heard about these unconventional clinical approaches maybe in a negative report, like a Newsweek cover story or something. And as long as they spelled the name right, that is these journalistic entities of whoever they were dismissing, the patients who could read between the lines would use them as a resource to track down those therapies. So it's a very complicated picture, and we're certainly not going to finish the discussion here, but I'm glad we're starting it, because it's something that usually isn't even considered. And when I used to do public speaking at health and cancer conventions back in the day, rather frequently, and often talking about the politics of cancer, occasionally a cancer patient who would be at one of these meetings would ask me, well, you know, why are you giving us this bad news about the politics of cancer? And I said, well, you know, I think that if you really have an understanding of what's behind, what's at the basis of these conventional therapies that are being given to you, you know, without allowing anything else, any competition, it'll give you enough insight or some insight so that you can make a more informed decision clinically and medically. And I still feel that way today. But if you have any response to that, feel free. I'll give you the floor right now.
Well, I think that one of the big differences between now versus the 1980s, as far as the mainstream media is concerned, is advertising. Because if you look at who's advertising, it's mostly medical stuff now. And so they're not too likely to want to bite the hand that feeds them. Sometimes I speculate too that as fewer people are involved in religious activities, that it's almost as if they've transferred their faith in some sort of power that's going to take care of them to the white coats at the major medical centers. I don't really know, but I think certainly the dollars involved in advertising are a huge issue. I'm not saying that the journalists are necessarily consciously saying we can't annoy our advertisers by publishing this or covering this, but it's bound to affect them to some degree.
I'm so glad you raised those points. That's very, very relevant to our discussion. Absolutely. And it might not even be so much the journalist, but at a higher level of executives who run journalistic entities, whether newspapers, online, broadcast television, you know, the news departments of broadcast television, even cable news, have actually shrunk. When people say, well, you know, Fox News, for example, they should have gone more deeply into this or that issue. Well, it's not like they have huge investigative departments that can turn on a dime and stop at nothing to do work in ferreting out the truth in these very complicated stories. I mean, they're in many cases doing seat of the pants, day by day journalism to understandably win an audience and make money for their investors or owners. So that's the nature of the business behind the screen. And to an extent, it's always been that way, but the news industry has actually shrunk a lot since the 1980s. And, you know, there are reports out there as well, most of them anecdotal and they're hard to confirm, but that even in the issue of vaccination, for example, there are reports that none other than, and I don't know the validity of this, but I've read these reports unconfirmed, that Robert F. Kennedy Jr., whose organization ChildrensHealthDefense.org I have mentioned frequently as a leading resource on the issue of COVID-19 and everything about it, including the so-called vaccines. And of course, he's coming from the progressive liberal left, but his and his associates' information is superb. And there are reports that when he, even before COVID, tried to get his criticisms of vaccinations, I mean, he's not an anti-vaxxer, but he raises important questions based on the scientific literature, well annotated. He was unable to get, in this case, Fox News to have him on or cover anything because allegedly he was told that, no, this, we simply can't do this because a majority of our advertisers are, from the pharmaceutical industry. And you just have to watch not only Fox News, but any of the cable news channels. And that's the case. And just like in the old days, so to speak, when, medical journals, I guess they still do. I read them online, so I don't know what their advertising is in print form, if they're still publishing in print. They used to run a lot of ads for the pharmaceutical companies. Of course, they weren't going to publish. It was obvious they were not going to publish articles or studies in their august journals that would highlight a non-drug approach, since that was their bread and butter. So, again, these are very complicated issues, but, you know, at least we're having a chance to compare notes on them.
Yeah, they are complicated issues. And I think that doctors can be, well, doctors like to think that all of the advertising that the pharmaceutical companies send in their direction doesn't influence their prescribing habits. But I think that the pharmaceutical companies know that it does, and that's why they spend apparently more money on advertising than they do on research.
Right.
And
some of the ads, if you watch, for example, you know, when you're in the journalistic profession on the right of center, you often have Fox News on a lot, even if it's got the volume down, because you have to keep up with breaking news. And who else are you going to watch? Not CNN. You see the 20 minutes an hour devoted to commercials and the endless repetition of ads for certain pharmaceuticals, which after the thousandth viewing of a particular ad are just driving you nuts to see it again and again and again. It's just insane. I want to ask you about this while I've got you here, and I don't want to put you on the spot, although you referenced it a bit earlier. You know, in 2015, coincidentally, as it were, the same year, if not summer, that our friend Dr. Nick Gonzalez passed away, this dead doctor's meme appeared. And it posited that alternative therapy clinicians were being one by one taken out by some unnamed nefarious powers that be because they were getting too dangerous. And to my astonishment and dismay, the name of Dr. Gonzalez was added to this list almost immediately after his passing, because he did pass away suddenly. Most people thought he was in excellent health. You mentioned that, and I knew this myself, that he was working too hard. He was burning himself out on one issue. I don't know if that was led to a terminal condition, but I wonder if you want to comment on this. What do you think when you hear these reports that are still out there to this day being promoted, these claims that not only are there 100-plus clinicians who were eliminated, but that Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez was essentially one of them who was bumped off. What do you think when you hear these kinds of his name referred to in that way?
Well, I know you made a reference earlier to someone you were speaking with. I think it was Diana West. I'll have to look her up, but that she was saying that too much news can make you crazy. I'm kind of paraphrasing here. But that whole thing kind of fit into the category for me of I can't do anything about it, so I'm not going to worry about it too much. I find it hard to believe that anyone is sufficiently threatened by the alternative medicine community that they're out there systematically killing people. And I personally don't believe that that's what happened with Nick, but I don't have any way to know, you know, for sure. I believe that it is possible to simply work too hard and wear yourself out, and that's what I observed. But I don't know.
Yeah, and
in the moment, you know, at the time, I was just swamped with my own personal grief, but also the grief of the patients. I felt like I was, in effect, going to a funeral every day for 6 months to a year, because I would have people come in to see me, you know, that had formerly been Nick's patients. They would come in, they would sit down, they would burst into tears. And that's what I was dealing with every day. So fitting any time into investigation of that whole, you know, alternative doctors, sequence of mystery, so to speak. I felt a little, I think, annoyed that somebody was using that as a way to publicize themselves. I don't know. I don't know what I think, to be honest.
I think that's a very salient comment, and I agree. I did probably more research and looking into it than you had the opportunity to. And I was always skeptical. And not only that, I won't speak for her, but Nick's widow, Mary Beth Gonzalez, I was closely in touch with her during that period in the aftermath of his death. And the cause of his death was investigated. And I'm not aware of any evidence that came up showing that there were suspicions of anything untoward involving his passing of the scene. But and I also, I think it's pretty clear that people were using, well, you know, I don't often or recommend something like Snopes, but they did a review of this dead doctor's meme going case by case. And I'd noted some of this myself in my own research, and they pretty much nailed it correctly that any physician anywhere or anyone medically associated anywhere who died at an early age or an age that seemed too early would be put on that list, even if they weren't working in alternative medicine. And there was one of them in Spokane, I remember, researching that seemed not appropriate for that list at all. We've got about 10 minutes left, so I want to run through a few more questions here. Now, I began reporting on the official government's war on cancer soon after it was declared by Congress and President Nixon in 1971, almost 50 years ago now, and Nixon, of course, promised that we'd have a cure for cancer in time for the bicentennial in 1976, and that came and went. I wonder if you could share what you think your overall assessment is of where we are in the conventional fight against cancer today, approaching the 50th anniversary of the declaring of the war on cancer.
Well, I think that there are some areas, in fairness to the Orthodox guys, where there has been clear progress. So, for instance, the childhood leukemias, certain types of diagnoses in adults. To a large extent, though, I would say we've taken a giant step sideways. Probably the biggest improvements have been from the reduction in smoking as opposed to treatment. But I certainly think we spend a lot more money on it, But whether huge advances have been made, I think is a little debatable.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. And I should mention, as I should have earlier in this hour, that for those listening, I'm Peter Barry-Chalka, guest hosting the Hagman Report today, May 5th, 2021. And my guest in this hour is Linda Isaacs, medical doctor, who is a nationally, if not world-renowned, authority in the field of innovative, natural, non-toxic therapies. And now, do you see the future of cancer treatment? I mean, are you optimistic that it will, as we go forward, include more nutrition or maybe immune therapies or something else on the horizon that you're looking at?
Well, I do think that things have improved, widened out a little bit in terms of how the orthodox world is starting to look at cancer. Some of the things that occur to me, for instance, with some of the new immunotherapies, and those are some of the things that you'll see widely advertised on television as offering new hope for people mm-hmm. with lung cancer, for example. And one of the things that they found with that class of medicines in some cases is that in some of the, it seems like people with a healthy microbiome, you know, the bacteria that are in their gut, which basically comes around a diet, but people whose microbiome are in better shape do better with those treatments. And so the implication is that it does matter what you eat. And bit by bit, I think that the importance of nutrition is becoming more apparent to the oncology world. So I've also found that there is a little bit more open-mindedness, a little bit less harassment of the patients by the oncologists, you know, because many of my patients also do see an oncologist. And so I think the world is improving as far as that goes. And there's actually more basic science research even supporting the work that I do, the use of pancreatic enzymes. Personally, I've never quite understood why that was considered so important, you know, as opposed to, you know, people will poo-poo case reports as, oh, that's just anecdotal. What we really need are cell culture experiments to prove the validity of what you're doing. And personally, I've always felt that case reports are a whole lot more interesting. But there is more basic science research being done bit by bit that may wind up supporting what I do. Who knows, in another 10 or 20 years, it may be part of the regular medical armamentarium.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to pause at this point and ask Eric, the tech back there at Master Control, if he can give me a heads up on how much time we have left in this hour, so will we make the best use of it and don't run out of time.
About 7 minutes, Peter.
Thank you, Eric. Okay. Now, we've touched on elements of this next question, but I just want to frame it very directly and get your response. Dr. Isaacs, you were with Dr. Gonzalez from the beginning of his career of clinical practice in the 1980s, and to broaden it out, how do you think alternative medicine has changed during that time, especially in terms of public awareness, public interest, and public acceptance?
Well, I think there's been a big change since the 1980s in terms of awareness and acceptance. For example, you wouldn't have seen organic food in just about every supermarket, which you can now. So there's a lot more awareness of food quality, for example. And you know, some people would argue that the organic food isn't what organic food used to be and et cetera. But nonetheless, I think there is more awareness of that sort of thing, or more awareness of the impact of pesticides, herbicides. All of that to me ties into alternative medicine, because that's about how our environment can affect our bodies. There's more awareness of things like acupuncture, chiropractic, you know, a lot of different modalities that are part of alternative medicine. Those things are more commonly known about. So I think there's been a fair, and then also you have the impact of some celebrities that will talk about their use of various things. So that has certainly expanded people's awareness quite a bit as well.
Now, a related question. How has the medical establishment's view, I mean, you've touched on this again, but I want to just really focus tightly on this. How has the medical establishment's view of so-called alternative cancer, alternative medicine evolved during the past several decades as well? Is there a light at the end of the tunnel there, do you think?
That's an interesting question, because what I've observed over the last 10, 20 years is a growing idea that integrative oncology, in other words, a little acupuncture to go with your chemotherapy, it's more geared towards trying to assist the patient as they go through orthodox therapy, as opposed to what I'm doing, which is really designed to be a true alternative. I'm not saying that that's not important or valuable, but I guess for myself anyway, I'm more inclined to look, to say, is the orthodox treatment that's being administered actually particularly beneficial, and are there other options? You know, in some ways, I wound up doing the work that I do really through a series of moments of serendipity, you know, meeting Nick Gonzalez when I was a medical student. He was an intern. You know, he was an intern in Nashville, Tennessee, which for a native New Yorker is probably about the last place you would have expected him to turn up. But I got to know him then. I got to know about his research into Dr. Kelly. And from there, one step has led to the next. You know, I've seen patients do well. I have patients in my practice that should have been dead many, many years ago, and they're alive and well, and witnessing milestones in their families' lives that they would have missed if not for this treatment. So in some ways, I guess I don't really interact with the orthodox medical world enough to know how are people looking at it overall. I think many doctors, there are some that will still react in a threatened way, like, you know, how dare you as a patient think that I don't know everything there is to know. But I think that many doctors are more open-minded about it, and I have several physicians in my practice.
Well, I appreciate that answer, and that helps us end on a positive note. And once again, to get in touch with your work, Dr. Linda Isaacs, can you mention and recommend your website once again before we close out?
Sure. My website address is www.drlindai.com. So that's drlindai.com. And there you'll find a description of what I do. And if you want to follow through, there's instructions for what to send in about yourself so that I can assess whether or not I think it can be a benefit.
Dr. Linda Isaacs, thank you so much for joining me today for this conversation. And this is the third one we've done here on the Hagman Report, the most recent, of course, today. And I think this is going to be my favorite. I really enjoyed this conversation and appreciate it. So thank you again, and be well.
Well, thank you. And my regards to Mr. Hagman as well.
Thank you. Now, just to close it out in the closing minute and a half here, I want to thank Eric the Tech and Doug Hagman for this opportunity to guest host the Hagman Report on this latest occasion. And I just want to mention, too, today is the 91st birthday of one of my mentors, Barry Farber, the talk show host who unfortunately passed away 1 year ago tomorrow, the day after his 90th birthday. And his children, mainly his daughter Bibi Farber, has started up a website as a memorial where she's posting all kinds of cool stuff, tapes, photographs, and they're having a Zoom or a Skype meeting today, which will be podcasted after the fact. So if you Google or search that, Barry Farber, I'm sure you will very quickly come upon the address of that website, and you can interact with the great memory of one of the great broadcasters of all time, Barry Farber, a true patriot and a true conservative. Well, I believe we're coming to the end of the Hagman Report here. Once again, I want to thank everyone who listened and watched the program today. And you can find my work at peter.media. That is a website. I don't think you need www anymore before that, but just put peter.media, M-E-D-I-A, into your web browser or your phone, and you will find me, Peter Barry Chalka. And there's an address there, too, an email address if you want to reach out and touch. So thanks again. Thank you for listening and watching. God bless you, and God bless America.